Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Well, so we've covered two of the main points that I wanted to cover. Let's turn to the third, and then I'm going to sneak a fourth one on you, but I think you'll like it. So I'm going to set this up by talking about your sister, Jane Ann Peterson, is it?
No, Jane Ann Hunter.
Jane Ann Hunter, okay. So Jane Ann Hunter, when Margie and I, my wife, moved to Logan, Margie's mother was involved in a book club, a marvelous, splendid book club that had been in existence for several years prior. In fact, she's still involved in this book club, and it's a wonderful book club. I've attended it and I've spoken at it and reviewed a book. And I was touched by how much this book club meant to my wife, Margie. She just said the women there are thoughtful and they're loving and they're witty. And she talked about one woman in particular that was so delightful and warm and funny and charming. And her name was Jane Ann Hunter. She said that Jane Ann would sit there and she'd knit. She would sit there and listen in the book club and knit and often stay very quiet. But occasionally she would come up with these most insightful and witty and sharp commentaries, often that were alternative to the true believing Mormon perspective. This sort of grounded the discussions in reality and were just very wise and witty and sagacious. Mm-hmm. She described Jane Ann as being this delightful, charming woman. You know, in her 60s or 70s. Mm-hmm. And that's what I knew about Jane Ann. Mm-hmm. Then one day...
Let me ask you. I knew about this book club, and I knew Jane Ann belonged to it, and I knew that she enjoyed it very much. But I don't recall whether it was just Mormon women or was it...
It is just Mormon women.
Okay. Right? All right. Mm-hmm.
And they mostly read the classics, classic books. Mm-hmm. And but they're certainly not dogmatic.
It's not a relief society.
No. A lot of them joke about bringing a magazine and putting it in front of the end sign while they're in relief society. Uh-huh. Just being willing to stretch things and question mm-hmm. things. So anyway, one day a couple years ago, Margie and I got the news that Jane Ann had died, and we were stunned. Margie was stunned. I mean, she wept. She just right there wept. Jane Ann's dead. My mom just called me. Jane Ann's dead. Yeah. And I was absolutely just sad. And the explanation was that she had had a seizure. I forget exactly what the explanation was in terms of why they had why she'd had a seizure. But it was sort of she'd been to the hospital and had a seizure, and we were all left with the impression that she died of old age. Uh-huh. And it seemed so out of the blue because she was otherwise really healthy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Margie attended the funeral of Jane Ann, mm-hmm. and that was how it was portrayed during the funeral. Just that this beautiful, faithful, devout, God-fearing, committed to her marriage, believing Mormon woman had died, I guess, apparently of natural causes. And, let's celebrate her love for the church and her commitment to her eternal marriage and her love for her children, etc. And, that was how we all processed that event. And that's, in fact, how the members of the book club discussed the event after it happened, from what I understand. Then I'm in a statistics class, bored a little bit with the lecture, and I go up on the internet and I sometimes was reading the ex-Mormon forums at this point. I got on ex-Mormon forum and I'm reading a post that you made, and and it told a very different story. So what I would like to do, to the extent that you're comfortable, is have you back up, start from whatever beginning you're willing to, talk about your sister, talk about what she was like, what her dreams were, what some of her early accomplishments were in the performing arts, and then how the church and her marriage led to what you understand to be the real story behind her death.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope I can do it without breaking up. Jean Anne was not quite 2 years younger than I, and she had a similar childhood to mine. I mean, we had the same parents, grew up in the same house. It was a little bit different because I was the boy and she was the girl. We were the only two kids for about 11 years until, well, about 9 years until my parents got a little bit stronger religion and my dad was called to the stake presidency and he felt that they should have more children, and so they proceeded to have three more children. But Jane Ann and I were the two oldest by quite a bit. And I always felt that we were very similar. Many, many years later, I learned from Jane Ann that her childhood was different from mine in that she was the girl. And when mother became pregnant with the third child, dad took her aside and told her, "You are never, I don't ever want to see your mother mopping floors or doing dishes again now that she's having this other baby. That's your job."
Right.
And I wasn't aware that Jane Ann had had to take over the household, so much of the household duties. I was also aware, however, at the time, that she was quite overweight as a little girl and got teased somewhat for being a fatty. I did not know until many years later from Jane Ann that Mom and Dad had even taken her to a doctor to see if she had some kind of problem with her overweight. And apparently, Jane Ann resented very much the fact that they weren't willing to accept her the way she was. When Jane Ann went to BYU a couple of years behind me, she made a determined effort to lose weight, and she did. She became a very trim, beautiful woman, very talented. The photographs of her at that time show a really, really a glamour girl is what we'd call them in those days. Mm-hmm. And she fell in love with Ted Hunter, and he fell in love with her, who was a tall, handsome guy and still is a tall, handsome man. They met in music classes and musical things at BYU, and they married and began to have a family. We all felt that it was a good marriage and that they were going to be just fine, and they started to have kids. They had five, I think it is, altogether.
Now, let me just jump in. I heard at one point that she was something like a champagne girl on the Lawrence Welk show.
I think that she did do one stint on the Lawrence Welk show.
Explain what that means and explain what talent she had that would enable her
to. All right. She was this was another one of her problems, is that she was extremely talented. She had a beautiful singing voice. Really, until almost till her death, she had a beautiful singing voice. She appeared in any number of high class productions, operas, musicals. She Well, I think the Lawrence Welk thing is the, being a champagne girl on the Lawrence Welk show. I don't know if you remember what the Lawrence Welk show was like.
Tell us.
It was good family type music with a band, with orchestras and kind of community singing types things and dancing and just good wholesome entertainment. And the background was always bubbles rising right. up to the surface, like from champagne. And as I recall, he would have guest artists, and I think Jane Ann was one time did a stint as a guest artist on the Lawrence Welk show, and he had this thing called a Champagne Girl. I didn't really watch the show much,
but that's a pretty big deal, right?
Oh yeah. No, she was extremely talented. As a matter of fact, her talent was one of the things that was a great frustration for her, because when she was at BYU, she got an invitation to study with a famous operatic soprano. I'm trying to think of who it was. You'd recognize the name. Mm-hmm. In Indiana. Mm. And she would, it was a scholarship. And she wanted to go because she did want to become an opera singer. Mm-hmm. And I guess our dad told her, no, you shouldn't do that. You stay, that will take you too far away from home and from your family, and you need to stay here and begin to raise a family. Mm. And so she did not accept that offer.
Okay.
And I didn't know about it at the time. It was only many years later that Jane Ann told me about this and how it had broken her heart that Dad would not let her go. Mm. All during their marriage, she continued to act and sing in local productions. She played in the lead roles in Man of La Mancha and, half a dozen various musicals. And her husband, Ted, who was also a fine singer, he would sometimes appear in those shows with her. So it was an important part of her life. And she raised her kids also to be very musical. And her oldest daughter, Catherine, also ended up being even more talented vocally than her mother. Mm. Catherine sang with the San Jose Opera. Mm. Sang in Israel with the Los Angeles Symphony when they went there and performed for the Israeli Prime Minister. So she was, Catherine was in a way fulfilling Jane Ann's dream.
Right.
There were troubles in the marriage that a lot of us in the family were not all that aware of. One of them seemed to be that her husband, Ted, was a very controlling kind of person. And he insisted that he was the one to decide to make all of the decisions, even in very minor things like what clothes she should wear for a particular event. How she should spend her day. And we knew that this bothered her, but we figured, well, it's just his way, you know. Occasionally, when she was not around him, which was rare, she would get angry And she would say, oh, if he would only leave me alone sometime. You know, if he'd just stop trying to tell me all the time what to do. For whatever reason, and this may have played a part, there came a time when she began to rely on over-the-counter prescription drugs to preserve her ability to stay thin, because Ted admired very much what a slender woman she was. Mm-hmm. And she had a fear of getting fat again. She began relying on, tranquilizers, over-the-counter diet pills, and alcohol. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. before we knew it, she was alcoholic, which her husband did not understand. He just could not understand why she would do that, why she would drink. And we didn't understand really either quite why, but we realized, at least I realized, that it was a symptom of unhappiness. His attitude, so far as we could tell, was, well, it's just a matter of willpower. If she just stopped drinking, if she just be willing to obey the word of wisdom, there wouldn't be any problem. But she keeps drinking.
Right.
She struggled with the drinking for quite a while. And she'd be able to go on the wagon for a while, and then something would trigger it, and she would start drinking again. There were several times when she was hospitalized because she had taken too much of a pill, or she had slashed a wrist. I think that he had her hospitalized a couple of times in some sort of rehab program for a few days. He got her into psychotherapy. And after a few visits, the therapist told her that she needed to talk to her husband as well. And so he agreed to go in and had several sessions with the psychotherapist. And he came home from one of those sessions and told Jane Ann that the therapist was crazy, because the therapist was suggesting that part of the problem was him, that he wasn't the alcoholic. Jane Ann was the alcoholic. And so it was Jane Ann's problem, not his problem, mm-hmm. and he forbade her from going back to that therapist.
So do you think that, I mean, I once made the mistake of, blaming suicide on, some specific thing, as if like one thing causes anything so traumatic as suicide. And I'm applying that here to the alcoholism now. Some people are just alcoholics. I mean, it just happens. In mental illness, I'm studying mental illness, and sometimes some people have OCD, some people have depression, some people have anxiety, and it's going to happen in and out of a faith crisis, in and out of a controlling marriage. It can happen with somebody who's got the perfect life. And so, what I don't want to do is set this up like we're trying to necessarily put all the blame of the alcoholism on either the husband or the church or the expectations of the family, because I would guess that both you and I would say that things are always much more complicated.
Yes, I agree with that. Things are much more complicated.
But having said that, there are instances where people self-medicate because of sadness and feelings of unfulfillment or dissatisfaction with their situation, or dreams that could have been that never materialized, and they end up feeling trapped. So do you feel like there was some of that contributing to her situation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of those things, I'm sure, contributed. Before we start analyzing it,
finish the story.
Let me finish the story because what we learned was I learned about her death when Catherine, her oldest child, called me, and Catherine and I have become very close because Catherine also ended up leaving the church.
Mm.
And so she called me one morning, Uncle Richard, in tears, saying, "Mother, Mother's dead, and she's killed herself." And so she told me what had happened. Apparently, Jane Ann had, it was on a Sunday morning, and she told Ted that she didn't feel like going to church and for him to go ahead, go to church. And so he said, okay, yeah, he would. And so he left her, and she had started drinking again, I guess, in the last few days. Ted had apparently been quite careful to go through the house, hide all the liquor he could find and get rid of it, and take all the prescription drugs that he could find and get rid of them. He came home and found her unconscious discovered that she'd taken every aspirin pill in the house, and apparently aspirin can kill you. Got her into the car, drove her to the hospital, and they weren't able to revive her. I understand that there was a note saying, "I'm sorry," but the official word from the family that he wanted known was that she did not kill herself and that there was no note, and that was the story that went out. We also learned, Catherine also told me that, and I want to emphasize that up until the very moment of her death, I'm sure, Jane Ann was a devout believer. She was a believer in the gospel in every sense of the word. I think that part of her sadness that drove her to this and that drove her to the bottle was her own belief that she was not worthy enough, that she was somehow failing her Savior in not being able to be as good a follower of Jesus as he would want her to be. But she loved Jesus with all her heart. She felt she had a personal relationship with Jesus. She turned to Jesus in every time when she felt in need. She had been regularly attending the temple. I think there was a group of women that would get together and go to do a temple session about two times a week. And with Jane Ann being in the temple so often, I guess that the temple president finally approached Jane Ann and asked her if she would be interested in working as a temple worker in the temple. Mm. And so he told her to ask her husband if that would be okay with him, which is, of course, the Mormon way. The wife can't do anything without the husband's permission. And so I guess Jane Ann did ask Ted if he would object to her being a temple worker. And I understand that his response was, well, he didn't think that would be a good idea because it would take her away too much from the family. Which struck me as odd because the only family there was Ted and Jane Ann. Their kids were all gone and moved away, and yet Ted didn't want her to be doing that. And Catherine seemed to feel that that was just the straw that broke the camel's back, that it finally just pushed her over the edge. She had, you know, she'd suffered frustrations her entire life, frustrations in having to do everything that pleased Ted and avoid doing anything that displeased him. And yet that was, in the eyes of, I think, everybody in their Logan ward, that was an ideal Mormon marriage.
Right.
Now, I in that post you saw that I made the day that I learned of Jane Ann's death, I did blame the church. And to the extent that the church played a role in it, in determining for Jane Ann, directly or indirectly, determining what her life should be, which did not really coincide with what her life, what she wanted her life to be, and what it could have been, to the extent that the Mormon Church was involved in it, I do blame the Mormon Church. And to the extent that her husband, in being the kind of Mormon priesthood holder and head of the house that the church had taught him to be, I blame the church for making that kind of a man out of him.
Right. Man, that's a tough story.
Yeah, it is a tough story.
And what was so bewildering to me was processing it as it was told to us through the ladies in the book club and the family, which was, oh, she just died.
Yeah.
And then hearing the backstory. Yeah. And it was like one of these cinematic moments for me where, like, I had this just mind-blowing realization that amazing things and sometimes amazingly disturbing things happen in the privacy of families that no one ever hears about.
Yeah. And
then it's going on, and then it's going on right around us.
Right. Yeah. You know, being involved as I am with ex-Mormons, I hear stories like this all the time. For example, I was absolutely flabbergasted to have a man contact me who said that he'd found my story on the internet, and he grew up in my home ward in Blackfoot, Idaho, and he knew my family, and he was a couple of years younger than I, but he and his family lived across town in the poor section of town, and they were always envious of my family because we seemed to be better off. His family attended the same ward that my family attended, although by the time they were there, I was already BYU and had more or less left home. And then he told me that during the time that he was living in the ward where I grew up, he was continually abused sexually by some of the priesthood holders in the ward. And he said, he didn't like it, but he just assumed that that's the way it was. And it was only as he grew up and became an adult that he realized that that wasn't right. And I was astonished because I had no idea that that kind of thing was going on or that it could go on. And yet this sexual abuse of young kids is seems to be not an uncommon thing in Mormonism. As a matter of fact, we're so astonished and outraged at the uncovering of sexual abuse by Catholic priests of kids that are under their tutelage, and yet it seems to be almost as common among the Mormons.
That's hard to believe that it's as common for me.
Well,
but existent, yes, as common.
Well, but yeah. Well, if you want to talk about percentages, I think there are probably a great many more Catholics and Catholic priests and instances of Catholic abuse. There may be more numerically, but I think probably, given the few Mormons there are,
as a percentage-wise,
it may be rampant. I know that several attorneys that have been working on prosecuting cases against the Catholic Church for sexual abuse of kids, they're just waiting to get a breather in order to start coming against the Mormon Church. There are now, of course, some cases already that have appeared where the Mormons
are. Like in Oregon.
This Oregon case, yeah.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.